seventh parak in Nehemiah, chapter 7. We started on this last week. And what we had said was Nehemiah notices a problem. The problem that he's working with is the depopulation, or not really depopulation, lack of population in Yerushalayim. We said that there aren't many houses, or alternatively, the houses are not particularly well built and well defended. There aren't many people in Yerushalayim, which makes a lot of sense. It makes sense you wouldn't have a lot of people in Yerushalayim, right? Because remember the beginning of our book, right? When we started this Sefer, not the beginning of Ezra, when we started Nehemiah, we said the city was under attack. They didn't have a wall to defend them. They were under attack by the Samaritans. Things were in ruins. So when you think back to the beginning of Nehemiah, you know exactly why they have this problem. And it's not as though the work on the wall has brought in a flood of people. And therefore Nehemiah is concerned, and we said he's concerned either that because you have few people, you have a slim population, therefore you don't have people to defend the city. Having a wall is nice, but you need to actually be watching what's going on. You need to be standing guard. And that was one concern. And then the other concern is that when you have a sparse population, if there is an invasion in some part of the city, you're not able to gather to defend because you don't even know necessarily about the attacks. And Nehemiah comes up with a plan, and the first stage of his plan is to take a census. And we said that the goal of the census may simply be, because he wants to cast lots and say, as we're going to find out, 10% of the population has to go live in Yerushalayim, so you need to do a census for that purpose. I did note that it seems like the Dat Mikra might be adding a layer to this and saying what he really wants is to get the leaders into the city to participate in his plan, and he needs to do a census in order to summon them there. It's a ploy to get them into to get them there. We had a side note on the Gemara that talks about people not wanting to live in Yerushalayim, whether people like city life or don't like city life. But then we started on the census itself, and what we found was that he dredges up this old census that was done in the time of Zerubbabel. We said maybe that's in order to give people a sense of cohesion and legitimacy, linking them to the past. And he brings it here in the text itself. So sentences 6, right? Sentence 6 in chapter 7, if you're using the Stone Tanakh, page 1851. Sentence 6, all the way through to the end of the chapter, in sentence 72, is a reprint of Ezra chapter 2. It's very funny to me, you know, when you get in the Chumash, when you get to the parshios we're in right now, right, where this week we're reading Vayakhel Pekudei. So people ask, why do you need Vayakhel Pekudei? Parshas Truma is, here are the instructions for building the Mishkan. Parshas Tetzaveh is, here are the instructions for the clothing of the Kohanim and the last bit of the construction. And then in Vayakhel Pekudei you get, and here is what they did to build it, and it's a repeat, it's just past tense of what they built, and in Pekudei it said, here's the clothing that they made. And it's basically verbatim, you just switched from future, or not future tense, you switched from imperative to a description of what they did. And you can exchange them. So why in the world do you bother with that? And people, there are all sorts of divrei Torah, very nice ideas about it, showing that they followed through when they did what they were told to do, which is rare for us, you know, and the like. And then you get later in the Torah to Parshas Naso. And in Parshas Naso, when they dedicate the Mishkan, we have the offerings brought by each of the Nisiyim, the heads of each tribe. And each one, it takes 6 sentences, 7 sentences, 8 sentences to describe what that Nasi brought, what that prince brought. And it's repeated over and over and over again. And this one brought, same list. And this one brought, same list, just changing the name and changing what day it was in the process for 12 days. And again, all the Divrei Torah, all the analyses of why did the Torah go out of its way to tell us this? But they have nothing on what we're seeing here, which is 66 or 67 sentences that are basically a repeat of what we saw in Ezra 2. So why is this? In fact, we printed it. Forget why he does the lineage again. That we've explained. But why include it? Why canonize it in the text? And we offer 2 explanations. One, from the Dan Mikra was to suggest that it's out of pride in the initial Olim, the people who came, you know, initially. It's like an encore for them. Like, hey, weren't they great? Let's applaud them again. Or alternatively, this idea that I really liked from Tamar Cohen Eskenazi, which I brought at length on the sheet last time, but we were at the end of the class, and that's why I'm taking time on it now to make sure that we grasp what she was doing. In which she said it's really marking the end of the unit, and that there are three units in this book, and they are punctuated by the emphasis on the people. So the first unit was just the opening five sentences or four sentences in Ezra, in which we were presented with the mission. The nation is to go back to Judea and is to build the temple. Then you had everything from then until now, which is the actualization. First, the construction of the temple. Ezra arrives, bringing the Karbanot to dedicate it, bringing the offerings, and then Nehemiah arriving as well and building the wall for Jerusalem. And now that you've completed that, you've finished this phase. So again, here's a list of the people, because we keep coming back to the nation themselves as the focus. And then the last part of the book, everything after this list going forward, is going to be about the success of the mission, how we succeeded in dedicating the wall, restarting Judaism. And even though the truth is that it's not all going to look like a success, as we'll see, they're not out of the woods. Nonetheless, that's your third section. So again, the break point between 1 and 2 and 2 and 3 is this name list. And that's what's accomplished by placing it here in the book. Okay. Yes?
Is there something to be said, I still don't know if anybody that none of these people left and they're still around? I mean, by reiterating all these names again,
right.
This has been quite a number of years. Things have not gone well.
Right.
And yet these people have not left town.
Right. So I wish that were true. I wish that were true. Meaning, you know, Dahlia's suggestion that we're highlighting the fact that they're all still around would be great if they all were still around. But as we're going to see momentarily, they aren't all necessarily still around. I forget if it's Malbim or Mitzudat David. It's Mitzudat David who's going to say that actually some of them left. But otherwise, yes, it would be wonderful. These people who we're going to mention are the ones who are still around. We're not mentioning the ones who skipped town. But in order to introduce that point, you have to get to a key question, which is, even though I have said now a couple of times that this is carbon copy of Ezra chapter 2, it's not a carbon copy of Ezra chapter 2. There are, in fact, some differences, and not the sort of differences that you really like to see show up in a canonized book of Tanakh. Right? When they have the texts in front of them, there's really no excuse for this. On your sheets, I gave you bullet points in source number 1 to show you 5 different types of variations. We are not going through this list to find all the different variations. If you are a masochist, I am willing to take a picture of the footnote that I have in the Dan Mikra where he lists for you all of the differences, and then I can email it to you and you can then, you know, go one by one, or you can just read and, you know, pick it out yourself, and I'll see you in a month. But I do want to highlight the types of differences. So some of the differences, as I wrote there on the sheet, are changes in spellings of people's names, or a letter is added, a letter is missing, the sort of things that aren't shocking. So for example, I gave you the contrast there between Ezra chapter 2, sentence 6, and Nehemiah chapter 7, sentence 11. You might want to just keep a hand in both places for the next couple of minutes to make this easier. Ezra chapter 2 is page 1815. Whereas the Nehemiah list is page 1851. See that? There's another difference. It's 1-5 in Ezra, it's 5-1 in Nehemiah. So, if you look at chapter 2, sentence 6, in Ezra, in the original list, so it lists B'nai Pachas Moab, those who were members of the family of Pachas Moab, remember we said that might be David, Livnei Yeshua Yoav, which they translated of the children of Yeshua and Yoav, but there's no Vav. It could be the sons of Yeshua are Yoav, for all I know. Same exact thing plus a letter is going to show up in the Nechemiah list in sentence 11, B'nei Pachas Moav, Livnei Yeshua V'Yoav. Very small, but if I'm transcribing a list, it shouldn't be there at all. That's a minor change. More significantly, take a look, please, in Ezra at chapter 2, sentence 2, at the beginning of the list. It describes the leadership, the people who are Zerubbabel's associates. So back on page 18, 14, 18, 15, you look at your names. And Zerubbabel's allies are Yeshua, Nehemiah, Seraya, Re'elaya, Mordechai, Bilshan, Misfar, Bigvai, Rechum, Ba'ana. Those are your leaders. I want to highlight for you specifically that when you look at the list on page 1850, 1851, in chapter 7, sentence 7, compare the two. Your list starts off well. Yeshua, Yeshua. Nehemiah, Nehemiah. But then you have Azariah in Nehemiah. There was no Azariah in the old list. And the old list had Seraya, who doesn't appear in the Nehemiah list. And then you have Ra'amya in Nehemiah, Re'elaya, if you're looking in Ezra. So you have a name that's missing, you have a name that's been added, and you have a name that's been changed. You follow? Yeah, you can start to see why I'm not doing this for the entire thing. But if you're really transcribing a list, why is a new name showing up? Why is an old name disappearing? And why is another name showing up in a different form? Right? Re'elaya becoming, what was it in Nehemiah? Ra'amya.
Didn't you say it was
60
years possibly?
Oh, yeah. But you're looking at a piece of paper. It's not like you have to remember something. He has a piece. This wasn't memorized. No one assumes it would be a good approach. But he says, "I found it in a book, right?" But inside, I found a text. It said in Nehemiah chapter 7, sentence 5. He said, "Va'ansa sefer hayachas." I found the book of, right, the text of lineage of those who came. Va'ansa kasuv bo, and I found the following written in it. Had it been something people sang around a campfire, I can't imagine the tune. But had it been something like that, then yes, a vav crept in, a name got changed. I'm good with that idea. But it's not it, and not only that. Again, canonization. Right? Your sages are sitting there in a room looking at this text. Why doesn't it look the same? Why is it not the same? And not only in terms of added names, subtracted names, but numbers change. Ezra chapter 2, sentence 5. The family of Arach is 775 people. I then get into the family of Arach in Nehemiah's list, and that's in sentence 10, and it's 652. Did 775 people show up? Did 652 people show up? What happened to the missing 133 people? Why isn't anybody worried about them? They missed their reservation at the restaurant, and everyone just said, "Well, great, I get their table." Why is this not a problem? The fact that you have a different group. Not to mention, I put it in the list of examples in number one. The donations at the end. At the end of your list of lineage, back in Ezra 2, it talked about donations that were made for the Mishkan. We're going to get a list of donations at the end of chapter 7. And number one, the sums are going to be different. And number two, we're going to highlight, you're going to like this, we're going to highlight Nehemiah's gift in the end of the list in Nehemiah 7. Didn't mention it in the list in Ezra 2.
So Nehemiah offered Ezra's list.
So that is what it looks like. It looks like Nehemiah changed Ezra's list. And the question is, well, not just whose is correct, but why edit the list? He can't possibly be more correct. It doesn't make sense for him to be more correct. He's not the one on the spot. How would he even know that there was something to correct? And if his list is correct, why didn't they, when they canonized Tanakh, why didn't they change the list in Ezra 2? Yeah.
Could there have been a deterioration of this paper? I mean, it was 60 years. Who knows what they wrote it in, what the clock or whatever they wrote on was.
Yeah. Entirely possible, but then again, when they canonize Tanakh, they're looking at both. You know, either change the first one or change the second one, but do something, because otherwise you look silly.
Or was it constantly edited?
Was it constantly edited, meaning? So, there are four different approaches to this problem. This is exactly the sort of thing that I don't want to spend too much time on, because it's not like you're going to learn great moral and ethical lessons out of this where people are going to come away with a nice Bar Torah, you know, that they can tell. It's just, at the same time, this is a problem. And it's not the sort of thing which you can seriously say, I learned Ezra and Nehemiah, if you're just going to avoid this issue. So, four different approaches on your sheet. The first approach is what I would like to see done for the entire thing, but it isn't done for the entire thing. And this is the approach of the Gemara and Megillah for one change. This is the approach that says, when you see something like this happen in Tanakh, there must be a reason for it, and therefore, we're going to analyze it and find what the reason is. But they only do it for one change. Out of all the changes on the list, they only do it for one. And it's the one that relates to the leader who came with Zerubbabel, whose name is Mordechai. Or Mordechai Bilshan, as we talked about when we did it back in Ezra, we noted the question of, is this the same as Mordechai of the Purim story? And the assumption of the Gemara is that this is the same as Mordechai of the Purim story. That creates certain problems if it's Mordechai of the Purim story, because that means that Mordechai of the Purim story, go back to Dahlia's point, that means that Mordechai came with Zerubbabel and then went back to Persia. Because Cyrus is before Purim. Mordechai can't be in Shushan if he's also in Israel. It doesn't work. So you have to assume that the Gemara is thinking that Mordechai made Aliyah, and then for whatever reason, went back to Shushan, and ended up there at the time of the Purim story. Otherwise, this doesn't work. The problem is our Gemara that we're about to see, source number two. You might as well see it. The Gemara picks up on the classic line from the end of the Megillah. Right, the last sentence in the Megillah. My father never tires of reminding me of this line. It says, "Ki Mordechai haYehudi Mishne laMelech Achashverosh," because Mordechai the Judean was the second to King Achashverosh. "VeGadol laYehudim," he was great for the Jews. "VeRatzui laRov Echav," and he was Ratzui, desirable, accepted. You can translate it in different ways. For Rov Echav, the word Rov could mean, and in context likely means, the many, right? The multitudes of his brethren. No, the simple read is not about that. The simple read is, Rov means he has a lot of brethren and they all love him. That's the simple read of the sentence. But it's not the way the Gemara reads it. The Gemara reads Rov to mean, the way it's used in other contexts, majority. Mordechai was beloved to the majority of his brethren, which is a really funny thing for the Megillah to say. Like, do we do that with our heroes? Like, we're going to go out of our way to say not everybody liked him? But that's what it says. Ratzui l'rov echav, and so the Gemara says, l'rov echav, for most of his brethren, v'lo l'chol echav, not all of them, milamed shepirshu mimenu mitza Sanhedrin, teaching that some of the Sanhedrin, he's supposed to have been a member of the high court, that some of them left him. When he got into this position of being, you know, working for Achashverosh, not everybody was comfortable with him anymore. Amar Rav Yosef, and then Rav Yosef picks up on one of the changes in our lists. In the list in Ezra chapter 2, when we listed the associates of Zerubbabel, we said it's Yeshua, Nehemiah, Seraya, Re'elaya, Mordechai. He's number 5 on the list. However, when you get to the list in Nehemiah, where we said we threw in a name, right? It was Yeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ra'amiah, Nachmani, and then Mordechai. So he's number 6 on the list. So the Gemara says, aha, that's what happens. Amar Rav Yosef, Gadol Talmud Torah Yosef Mehatzalas Nefashos. He says, you know, Torah study is even better than saving lives. Demei Kara Chashev Leila Mordechai Basar Arba. Mordechai was a scholar when the story began. And he was number 5 on the list. Ulubasov, but when Nehemiah gets to him, which is after the events of Purim, Basar Hamisha, he's number 6 on the list. He went down in the rankings because he got involved in, you know, running the community and saving people's lives. Now, that's a fascinating idea, right? Are you serious? Like, do you really believe that that's true? That we will actually value him less. You know, what kind of a polemic is this that we're trying to do here? Nonetheless, the message of the Gemara is that when you see a change like this, on one list he's after four names, on one list he's after five names, there has to be a meaning. And we're going to tell you what that meaning is. But like I said, there are a bunch of other changes where we have no text whatsoever to explain the change. Clear? Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Are the Dead Sea Scrolls,
are Ezra and Nehemiah found in the Dead Sea Scrolls? I don't know. I think I looked into that when we started Ezra, but that was already, you know, that's a year and a half ago. I'm not responsible to remember what I did back then. I think I mentioned it in the first class. So I'll have to look it up. There was Melech Halberstadt sent around a Purim Torah that he had seen on Megillat Esther in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Anyone see that? Yeah, he had found something. I don't think he wrote it. I think he was circulating it about Megillas Esther and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is not. There is no Megillat Esther in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But Ezra Nehemiah, I'll have to go back and check. I don't remember. This is one approach, is to say there is significance to every change, and if it's there, it's for a reason. And here's an example of that, but we don't have any others. Opposite pole. Rashi. Take a look at source number 3. He says, in a nutshell, don't worry about it. He says, Cheshbonot halalu, these accountings, pa'am hei mechuvanim in cheshbonot shamala, sometimes they match the accountings that went on in Ezra 2, pa'am hei she'ena mechavim ze keneged ze, and then sometimes they don't match. V'lo dikdei kamikra becheshbonos kol kach. It wasn't so careful, it wasn't so precise. Avala klal shavet, but when it gets to the final number of how many people came, that's going to be the same. So Rashi says, don't sweat it. It's very uncharacteristic of Rashi. That's not usually the way Rashi does things. I refer you back to the comment a few weeks ago that Rashi in parts of Ezra and Nehemiah may not actually be Rashi, and I wonder. This is so inconsistent. The idea that you're just supposed to ignore the variations. Rashi loves to tell you about the changes and why there are changes. But that's another approach. And then we have two more approaches which say, no, there's a reason for the difference, and it's based on what the list was supposed to be. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, and there's a similar idea found in Ibn Ezra, a similar idea found in Ralbag, is a practical approach to say the list was updated for Nehemiah's day. Meaning, he isn't just taking the list out of Ezra 2. That's not what he's doing. He's looking at the list of Ezra 2 and recognizing that in the decades that have passed, the society has changed. And certain changes have to be reflected if I'm going to make the census relevant for my day. What are the differences? So take a look at source number 4. There's a lot of text there. We're not going to go through... I'm going to go through in the English in the interest of time. I don't want to spend our entire time on this issue. He says, the specifics of the accounting, meaning in Nehemiah, do not match the specifics of the accounting in Ezra. Sometimes adding, sometimes subtracting. And some of the families are listed by Ezra and not here. And the opposite. And the sum of the heads of those who ascended adds here Nachmeni, who was not mentioned by Ezra. For Azariah, Ra'amiah, Nechum, Misparet mentioned here are the same as Sariah, Re'elayah, Misparachu mentioned in Ezra. They're similar in language. He's just pointing to the problems. He's pointing to the changes. They were known by two names, and there are many like this. Actually, I should take time. I'm rushing it a little too much. He says, when you look at this here, he says, we added in names, and we changed some names. So the first key point that he makes is that there were people who were known by two names, and there are many like this. And he's right, meaning in Tanakh that happens all the time. Names change marginally. There's Yoash and there's Yehoash. right? As one example, there are names that have a vav at the end and they lose the vav. There are many names that have minor variations. So he says, that doesn't bother me. And here too, there are many others whose names are different from those listed by Ezra. Fine. But it appears that Nachmani seems to be added to the sum of the heads of those who ascended. So he comes to his explanation. Perhaps Nehemiah did not copy all of Ezra's list as it was, unchanged. But he copied the general content. The first who ascended with Zerubbabel were in year 2 of Cyrus the Persian, and after many years, in year 20 of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, then Nehemiah ascended, and he found a text of lineage. So we could say that this Nachmani came at first with Zerubbabel, when he was young and not a leader, and he was included with the others who ascended. But by Nehemiah's time, he had grown in age and stature, and so Nehemiah saw fit to add him to the first and to mention him with them. In other words, if I see a name show up as a leader in the second list and not in the first, the answer is he was there in the first, but he didn't have standing. Names that are added in the second list are added because these are people who came of age and became significant before the second list was recorded. That's his argument. And he says, regarding the additions and subtractions to the number, we could say that many of them had died by Nehemiah's time. And many children had been born to them and had matured. So when Nehemiah came to mention in his census the family that had grown or shrunk, he wrote the number as he found it then, whether to add or subtract from Ezra's. The numbers changed because the numbers have changed over time. And when he said at the start, those who ascended from the captivity of the exile, even though some of them, people he's mentioning, have only been born afterwards, it was regarding most of them, not the small number, who were born in Israel and were not among those who ascended. And some of the families who ascended at first had disappeared by Nehemiah's time. And the remnant who remained were joined with families who were near to them, and they were counted with them. So families lost their status. And some of the families who were at first small in number had been joined with nearby families to be counted with them. And now in Nehemiah's time they had multiplied. He counted them as independent families. So there were shifts in family structure. There are shifts in family size. And that's reflected in it. And in the end of his words, when he summed them up, and with those who had come from the other tribes, even though it is a meaning not just Yehuda and Binyamin, but the other remnants of other tribes, even though it is unlikely that they would have neither decreased nor increased in Nehemiah's time over the original number, let me explain what he's doing. We already pointed out that even though the individual numbers are different, the total of those who came, the 42,360, that doesn't change. It's the same number in Ezra's time and Nehemiah's time. So he says, if you're really telling me he changed the list to update it, to reflect his day, you can't tell me it's the same number of people overall. It makes no sense. He says, you're right. Nonetheless, he says, the end of source number 4, Nehemiah saw fit to use the original sum and not the current one because the ones who had come from the captivity of the exile originally had only been in this number. He decided for the sake of nostalgia, I'm going to stick with the 42,360, even though the number makes no sense anymore. Nonetheless, it has a sort of sacred status to us, and so that's why he retains it. That's Mitzudat David's answer. They're all wrestling with a basic problem, which is this shouldn't be here. This shouldn't. I mean, the list can be here. We talked about why it's valuable to include the list, but it shouldn't be different from the list in Ezra 2. Well, the idea that this is an updated list works until he says there are 42,360 people showing up, when it's so clear that that number should have changed. So his answer is, that was a sacred number to them. That was like, in the same way that we look at the 600,000 men of military age in the wilderness and say, like, that's a special number, and it has all sorts of other places in Judaism where we reference it because we consider it special. So to them, he's saying that number was special. Last approach is Malbim. And Malbim says, these are two different lists. And you have to recognize that. And what he means by that goes back to a comment he made back in Ezra chapter 2, when he looked at the original list. And this is his argument. He says, look at the text itself in Ezra 2, when it describes the people who came back. Ezra 2, sentence 1. It's on page 1815. He points you to a subtle variation. between Ezra 2:1 and Nehemiah 7:6. In Ezra 2, sentence 1, it says, these are the people of the Medina who came out of the captivity in the exile that Nebuchadnezzar had exiled to Babel. And they came back to Jerusalem and Yehuda, each one to his city. Right? That was the sentence there. Now keep your eyes on that while I read you the Nehemiah text, because there are two key changes. The Nehemiah text says, and these are the people of the Medina, the same, so far the same, who came out of the captivity of the exile, so far the same, who had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Babel, king of Babylon. Gap. Word missing. To Babel. The word to Babel is missing in Nehemiah. That's your difference number one. Difference number two. They came back to Jerusalem and to Judea. And to, instead of just and Judea. So if you're a normal mortal and you read that, you don't even notice that there's anything different. But that's not the way Malbim works. Malbim is a throwback to the style of Midrash, and he notices everything. And he has an explanation for everything. And so here he says, what was Babel? You have to know history. What was Babel? When we say Babel, what are we referring to? No. We are not referring necessarily to the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire gets its name from the capital city, which was Babel. Babylonia is really the empire centered in Babylon. That's really what it is. That's point number one. So that when the original list said, these are the people who were exiled to Babylon, that's different from Nehemiah's list, which lists just people who were exiled, but didn't necessarily go to the capital city. Who goes to the capital city? Who gets exiled to the capital city?
The important people.
Because remember that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, exiled us in waves. There was the wave of the important people, the nobility. That's when Daniel and his friends went into exile. And then there was the destruction of the temple where he took everybody else. The leaders were brought to the capital. Everybody else scattered in the empire. So that's number one. He says, the list that you see in Ezra is actually a narrower list. It's only the elite. The list you see in Nehemiah is everybody. That's number one. Number two, the list back in Ezra said they returned to Jerusalem and Judea. The list in Nehemiah says they returned to Jerusalem and to Judea. Malbim is a grammarian. He says there's a difference between saying they went to Jerusalem and Judea and saying they went to Jerusalem and to Judea. What in the world is the difference between the two? He argues that where you have the word to, it means they actually went to both places. They didn't just go to Jerusalem, but rather they went to the general cities in Judea. They went to Judea as the place where they would live, as opposed to the initial group went to Jerusalem primarily, and then they may have gone around to Judea, but Jerusalem was primary. The point that Malbim is trying to make, and I'm trying to do this without reading you the text in number 5, I'm trying to explain it outside of Malbim's own text, is to say that your first list is the list of the people of status. The ones who went into exile first, who were in Babylon. Nehemiah's list adds the people who went into the later exile, who went to general Babylonian cities, and also returned eventually. And so he says, when you look at the population discrepancies, the extra names and the larger numbers found in the second list include people from the rank and file who joined the return after Zerubbabel altogether, but they came back eventually. So Nehemiah says, I'm putting them on the list too. What about the people who are on the first list and not the second list? What do you do with them? So he says, these are the people, and this goes back to Dahlia's point, these are the people who dropped out. When the construction of the temple halted, they went home. He also offers another suggestion to explain the missing name, numbers and names. He notes that some of the people are counted here based on their cities and some based on their families, and maybe there's some switching of that. But that's his approach. So fundamentally, if you want to know what we accomplished in the last half hour, we learned that we have a real problem with these different lists, and we learned four approaches. Approach number one is to say every change is significant, but we only know one meaning. An approach that says, don't worry about it, they didn't, so you shouldn't either. An approach that says, the list that you're seeing the second time is updated to reflect changes over time. And the fourth approach, that this second list is expanded, because it's not only a list of the elite, it's a list of everybody, which, by the way, fits Nehemiah's identity. Right? That fits Nehemiah's personality. So much has been anti-aristocracy in Nehemiah's approach that it's not surprising for him to say, I'm going to count everybody on my list. Karen.
Which one do you like?
Which one do I like? Kind of the one that's brought here in the name of Rashi, I think. Don't worry about it. I say in the name of Rashi because it's so uncharacteristic to see Rashi say it. But the truth is, I like that answer most, but it bothers me because, again, I feel like they're so careful with so many other things. It's really strange to see this carelessness. It is really strange to see this carelessness. I guess I between the two explanations of updated list versus broader list, Malbim is a more clever way to solve the problem, but Mitzudat David has the ring of truth. That it's simply Nehemiah updates the list based on what's going on decades later. That, to me, has the ring of truth. You know, it's the difference between a Gemara class in which you want to know, so what did the Gemara really mean, and Pilpul. The Pilpul, you know, you're going to pick up on fine points and come up with an idea that they never ever meant, but it would be cool because it solves all your problems. That's what I feel like when I'm reading Malbim here. He picked up on the extra lama here, and he picked up on the Bavel here, and he came up with this neat explanation. But I feel like Mitzudat David, the answer is it's an updated list, and be done with it. Okay. Like I said, we are not going through all of the differences in the list. I'm only going to pick out a couple of highlights that I think are worth noting. So take a look in Nehemiah now, chapter 7, sentence 7. The list of the elites who came with Zerubbabel. We're back on page 1851 if you're using the Stone Tanakh. So we listed Yeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, right? Ramya, Nachmani, and then the rest of the list we can ignore right now. So Re'elaya from the first list became Ramya here. Mispar, who's from towards the end of the list, became Misperet, which is also interesting. But in particular, we lost Sariah and we gained Azariah. Well, that's a really interesting thing. The reason why it's really interesting is because what was Ezra's father's name? Oh boy. Ezra's father's name. Go back to Ezra chapter 8. We had 15 generations, chapter 7 I should say, we had 15 generations listed for him. Right? We had a big deal out of that. Chapter 7, sentence 1. What's Ezra's father's name? Sorry?
Sariah.
Sariah.
Ben Azariah.
Ben Azariah.
And here's Azariah.
And here's Azariah. Exactly. So the question now is, the list as it appears in Ezra 2 has Sariah, Ezra's father. The list as it appears in Nehemiah 7 has Azariah, Ezra's grandfather. Right? There's got to be something going on. So if you look at source number 6 on your sheet, Rabbi Zakheim says, here's your answer. Azariah was the name of Ezra's grandfather. Since Zerubbabel preceded Ezra by several decades, right, this is the first wave of returnees, it is highly likely that the Azariah who appears in the census was Ezra's grandfather. He thinks Ezra's grandfather made Aliyah with Zerubbabel. I like what he did there. Then he does one of his fanciful things that I don't understand why he feels the need to do. He says, in fact, the presence of his grandfather in Judah may well have spurred Ezra to leave Babylonia. Scripture provides no other motivation for him to organize an aliyah, much less depart his native country. He has this additional idea. Once he suggests that Ezra's grandfather came on aliyah with Zerubbabel, he says, well, maybe that's why Ezra came. I mean, we have so many other things about Ezra, that is so many other facts about him that we know of that would have compelled him to go. He's this religious leader. He wants to drive that in Israel. I don't think it needs to be because granddad's there and I want to go take care of him. But that's Zachariah's solution. There's another solution that's possible, though. And that is that Azariah is actually Ezra. Don't look at it as the grandfather. Azariah, who's in our list with in Nehemiah, no, it is Ezra. Ezra. Azariah equals Ezra. I brought you source number 7.
That would be the grandson of the other.
Oh, the grandson of that original Azariah.
Yeah,
no, that's true. I didn't translate here because I ran out of room on the sheet, but I'm going to explain what you're seeing in source number 7. Source number 7 is a technical text. It's talking about names that appear in a get.
The etymology of Azariah.
Well, they're both the same etymology, to hell.
Letters.
Right. I mean, Ezra really is just an Aramaic version of Azariah. More or less. Azariah has the name of God in it. But fundamentally, it's just an Aramaic version of what you're seeing in the Hebrew. So what I brought you here, Rabbi Shlomo Luria records how you spell names in a get. And he quotes here, regarding this name, he says, V'ashem ha'ish Azariah, regarding the male name Azariah, v'koren lo Ozer. What do you do if you have somebody whose name, as he was named at his bris, was Azariah, but everybody calls him Ozer? So what do you write in the get? He says, Nirali, it appears to me that you should write Azariah with a hey, and you should write Azariah Dimitri Ozer. You write in the get, his name is Azariah, and people call him Ozer. With a get, I should explain, we're always concerned about writing all possible names, because we never want the nightmare situation in which somebody says, no, that's not really him, no one calls him that, his name is X. So what we actually do in a get is we collect all the nicknames, all the names that are used on registries somewhere, what's his driver's license under, whatever it is, and we'll say, his name is this, but he's also known as this, also known as that. So he says, that's what you're going to do in this case. And he says, Ozer, when you find the name Ozer, Ashkan Dechasim Bishtaros, we find that as a name signed on legal documents. People are called up to the Torah, he says, by the name of Ozer. So really, it's its own name. And you find it in the Torah as well. You find the name Ozer, he says. So you write Azariah, who is also called Ozer. And he says, you write it with a Vav, so that it'll say Ozer, because otherwise it could be Azer, which is another name. But then he says, don't worry that maybe we should include Ezra as well. Even though Azariah equals Ezra, as is found in the book of Ezra in various locations, he says. So he clearly believed that Azariah is Ezra. This is the only place he could be referring to. Azariah equals Ezra. And that would be the way to look at it. So maybe what's really going on here is that Nehemiah in his day is updating the original list from Zerubbabel's time and saying Ezra deserves to be there. He didn't join in with Zerubbabel. He couldn't have. It's an anachronism. Unless you do a radical rewrite, which we're not going to go into now because that's just going to give me a headache. But the idea is that this was when it said Sariah there, who's Ezra's father. Now we're updating it with Ezra himself. It's a possible explanation for what's going on here. And then you have another approach I didn't mention. Mitzudat David and Malbim actually say maybe Azariah is Sariah. We do that with generations in Chumash, right? Reuel and Yitro are a prime example of it, where sometimes it's Reuel, sometimes it's Yitro. One is the father, one is the son. Okay. After you get through your initial list of who came in, the next sentence 8 through sentence 38 is all the list of Yisraelim. 39 to 42, Lametet to Mem Beis, is the list of Kohanim. Mem Gimel to Mem Hei, 43 to 45, is the list of Levim. And then you get sentences 46 to 60, Mem Vav to Samach, is the list of the Nitinim and Avdei Shlomo. right? Nitinim and the servants of Shlomo. Nitinim, we said, were the people who were assigned to work in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, going all the way back to the Givonim and Joshua, who had fooled the Jews into making a pact with them, and updated at the time of David HaMelech, of King David. And then Avdei Shlomo, the slaves of Shlomo, we said when we learned Ezra, refers to the Knanim who Shlomo captured, and he turned them into servants. It's not so clear that they actually work in the sanctuary, the Avdei Shlomo. From the text in Divrei Hayamim, in Divrei Hayamim 2, chapter 8, it sounds like they were just generally a lower class. But they had some standing in society such that there were people who converted to Judaism just to become servants of Shlomo, the Talmud, as the Talmud discusses in Yevamot. Okay, so that's the Netinim, that's Shlomo's servants as well. And then in sentences 61 and 62, we're flying now, you have the people who can't prove their Jewish status. Here's something interesting. When we learned about this in Ezra chapter 2, right, our concern was people who couldn't prove their Jewish status because they had been in Babylon for 70 years. And who knows what happened in Babylon? But now, if we're updating this list for Nehemiah's time, what else are we concerned about? Intermarriage in his day. Right? The intermarriage that we discussed already in Ezra and Nehemiah is an added concern. So if I take the approach of Metzudat David, that this is an updated list, that makes sense as a special concern here. And then you get people who lacked documentation for their kahuna. Kohanim who thought they were Kohanim, but couldn't actually prove that they were Kohanim. And so we say, take a look in sentence 65, chapter 7, sentence 65. Vayomer ha-tirshata lahem. The tirshata said to them, the governor said to them, that's Nehemiah, that they shall not eat from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, until there would be a Kohen who would be able to use the Urim Betumim to speak to God to find out what the story is. Now I should note, we generally assume this is referring to Nehemiah. Rashi, Talmud Yerushalmi assume that it's Nehemiah as well. The problem is that the Tirshata shows up in the first list also. So either that's back changed from Nehemiah's day, or it's whoever was the governor back in those days. But either way, these are people who are not allowed to serve. By the way, 1 second digression, but worth it for your Pesach Seder. Go back for a second to Pasuk Samach Dalet, sentence 64. Eile bikshuk savam hamisyachsim velo nimsa. They went looking for their book of lineage, couldn't find it. And then what does it say? How do you translate that? What do they do here? They were disqualified from the kahuna. How does the word vayego alu mean disqualified? What is the root of vayego alu? Gaal, ligol, geula. They were geula, they were redeemed. What do you mean they were disqualified? So I just gave a share this morning at Out of Israel about this. I did a lot of work on this word Geulah and where it shows up. Not only where it shows up for us in Tanakh, but also in the Dead Sea Scrolls, since we mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls before, in the Temple Scroll. And it's a very funny thing. The word Gimel Aleph Lamed, in a nutshell, refers to taking something out of where it has been. That's really what Geulah is. It was somewhere, it will be taken out. Everything from Hamalach HaGoelo Timi Kol Ra, which is the first appearance of that root, Gimel Aleph Lamed in Chumash, to Hashem saying, Galti Etchem, right? I'm going to take you out, obviously, of bondage in Egypt, to the idea of Boaz being the Goel for Ruth. It's the guardian who has to take someone out. The Goel Hadam. Right, the redeemer of the blood, as we call it, is the relative who's going to save, or in this case, posthumously save, the person who was murdered, to being Goel a field in the time of Yovel, the time of when you have the 50th year. All sorts of uses all fit that, and even when it's a negative. Those who were here when we learned Sefer Daniel, right, we did this, Daniel 1, so it's got to be 5 years ago, at least. The Daniel says, I don't want to eat the scraps from the king's table. Levilti yit ga'al. And I don't know what levilti yit ga'al means. And it's a very difficult line. However, you find that that root, Gimel Aleph Lamed, is used in Daniel and in Malachi and here to refer to something that is to be removed, to be taken out of where it is, in those cases, because it is impure. Malachi criticizes the Jews for bringing on the Mizbeach lechem migoal, bread that should be taken out. The yidgaal, I would be like something that should be removed if I ate from Pat Bag HaMelech, if I ate from the bread of the king's table. Vayigoal lumen hakeuna, they were removed from being kohanim.
What's the word
magil?
That's with an
ayin. Yeah. That's with an ayin. Even though magil and hagalah sound really good for this, but it doesn't work. What I saw that tweaked me to the explanation is one of the commentators on the temple scroll, where it talks about tigolet as something that is impure. They noted Yeshaya chapter 4, sentence 4, talks about so'ah. And the Targum on it translates so'ah as tigolet. So'ah is excrement, filth. Something that was removed from where it was, or is to be removed from where it is, depending on how you read it. But that's what Geula is, to be removed from where it has been. The reason I like this idea so much, this shir from this morning, was because of the contrast between Purim and Pesach. At the end of Purim, right, have we gotten anywhere? Right, like the Gemara says, Akhati Abdei Achashverosh Anan. Achashverosh is still the king, and he's still levying his taxes. Esther is still trapped in the king's palace. Right, the king who had signed on willingly to Haman's plan, right, is still in power over us. The Beis Hamikdash is still on hold, right, because it was halted before Achashverosh's time, and it's only going to restart in Darius's time. We are no better off than we were in the beginning of the book. All we have is the simcha of relief. The current threat has passed. As opposed to Pesach, where we say, the way you saw Mitzrayim today, lo so sifun ro samod ad olam. You're never going to see them like that again. Mitzrayim will never again be a threat to you. That's the meaning of Geula.
Except that the only holiday we will observe in Mashiach's time is Purim.
Possibly. Possibly. I mean, no, because the language of the Rambam on it that people quote is that the book of Esther, is that Purim will never halt. That's what he, I think that's what he says. I'm not sure he says that the other holidays all, may I have to go back and take a look? Let me,
He doesn't say that they will exist.
Right.
And also that the miracles of Mitzrayim will pale by comparison.
Right. I mean, the fundamental message that I take from it is that we all deal with, you know, crises and problems and so on, and usually it's in a Purim way, right? Meaning, I got through this crisis. And there's another one around the corner. Right now, I have my simcha that I got through this crisis. But you have to have a hope of Geula. You have to see yourself as though you underwent Geula. You have to be able to see an end to all crisis. That's Geula. So, vayigoalu mina kehuna, they were taken out of, it's not a positive in this context, but in general, that's Geula. Okay, that's just a side note, but at least, you know, it's a very dry day, so we got something in that wasn't quite as dry. And you got what I did there in an hour, or I just did in 3 minutes. The rest of this list here, right? So you have the, in sentences 63 to 65, the people who lack the documentation as Kohanim. Sentence 66 is the summary, where it says that Kol HaKahal Ke'achad, the entire community together, is 42,360, right? Which, again, is the original number, even if it's no longer true by Nehemiah's day. And then you get the slaves and the singers, the people who sang. We said when we read this in Ezra that Rashi said the people who sang in the joy of ascending from Babel, and now they're going to, as Ibn Ezra said, they're going to sing to God. Notice as well, as we noted back then, that you have male and female, Meshorim u'Meshorot. So someone's got female singers as well as male singers. Obviously all done in a permitted way, but worth noting. And then sentence 68, you start on the Gemalim. You have the Gemalim, the camels, and the Chamorim, the donkeys. And as we noted back in Ezra 2, These are not the animals they take with them that they're going to use domestically in their new land. These are travel animals. These are pack animals, right? The donkeys and the camels are for the journey. And then we get to the last part of the list. Take a look, please. Sentences 69 to 71 here. Umiksas Rashei Ha'avos, and some of the leaders of the clans, Nasnu La'malacha, gave for the work. Hatirshata Nasan La'otzar, the Tirshata, the governor, Nehemiah, gave for the storehouse, Zahav, gold, Darkimonim, Elef, the 1,000 Darkimonim, Mizrakot Chamishim, 50 ladles, Katnot Kohanim, Shloshim V'chamesh Mayot. Wow. 530 garments for the Kohanim, a nice big gift, and then it tells us what the rest of them gave. So I guess we'll have to pick up on next time. We didn't quite get to the end of the list, but we got close. Are the donations for the work, because these are very different from the donations listed in Ezra 2, and we've thrown in Nehemiah to boot. So we'll have to discuss that, and then move on to chapter 8, in which the Jews are now ready for a big public Torah reading, which is going to change their community entirely. So we'll pick up with that, God willing, next Tuesday. Thank you.